BBC Sounds. Music, radio, podcasts.
Five Lives, Rugby Union Daily.
Rugby Union Daily, Monday morning, match week 4 of the 2024 Six Nations. And what does this weekend have in store? Scotland go to Rome to face Italy. England host Grand Slam chasing Ireland at Twickenham. And France go to Cardiff to play Wales. And today on the Daily is the latest in our rivalry series. We've had Sam Warburton on England-Wales, Gregor Townsend on England-Scotland, Tom Shanklin and Shane Horgan talking all things Ireland-Wales. And today, with the Irish heading to Twickenham on Saturday, it is all about England and Ireland and a rivalry that dates back to 1875. And no better man than the 100-cap man, Jamie Heaslip, an old friend of the pod, old in experience but not in years. Jamie, great to have you back on. And as always, we marvel at the backdrop to your Zoom with those caps that outline the great career you had.
Yeah, I had a good old run. But firstly, I must say, I'm a big listener of the pod.
Good.
So I really like your perspective on things. So always nice.
Well, this
to be
is
on.
A mutual loving. This is quite sickening, isn't it?
I'll win the English listeners over before I slate England later on, right?
Right.
But it's great.
Good stuff. Yes, daily's coming every single day. We've got the Nations Pod. We'll be inside the England camp. We'll have a special on France. We will dissect the teams when they come out. We'll be on the ground in Twickenham, on the ground in Cardiff and beyond. But Jamie, today's all about England-Ireland. So for you, what does this fixture mean? And I mentioned that it goes back to 1875. That predates England-Wales. You know, often considered one of the greatest rivalries in rugby, England-Wales. But this one goes back even earlier. What does it mean for an Irishman?
I think, look, there's always been a rivalry there between the two countries, I've always said this, it could be tiddlywinks and there would be a rivalry between England and Ireland. But there's also a mutual respect, particularly in rugby. We have been the minnows for a long time, and people kind of, I think, recently forget the schoolings that we used to get from England for a long, long time. Obviously, we've been on top for the last few years in most cases, but there's still a massive respect there. You see it at the club when we play the club sides at Europe. There's a lot of, like, the intensity goes up a level. And I think particularly over the last 10 years, there's been a bit of back and forth in terms of, you know, us winning there, England winning in Dublin sometimes. There's a mutual respect between the sides, given the calibre of players that are in the UK.
Yeah, and before we sort of go back into the history books a bit, Jamie, you mentioned the schoolings Ireland have had, and through the amateur era, bar little, you know, pockets here, especially the 70s, but I do want to touch upon, because that's obviously a very, you know, poignant part of the history of this rivalry. But on the whole, there's periods of English domination. So would you urge Ireland fans to just have that in the back of their mind, because it's going to be a lot of confidence, isn't there, going to Twickenham? I mean, you won 5 times at Twickenham in the Six Nations era. It doesn't hold that kind of awe factor it may have done. But for you, did you just always have to remember, yeah, this is still a rivalry that goes back a long way, and it hasn't always been in Ireland's favour like we've got now?
Well, it's weird, right? Because the current crop of Irish players really only mostly know beating England, be it home or away. I think the awe and the fear, well, not a fear factor, but the added factor of playing in England's back garden, they're not fearful of that at all now. Previous to that, obviously, it was a tall task in everyone's eyes to go to Twickenham and get a win. And I remember that. I remember being on the receiving end of a few beatings. But this current, so the fans, given the demographic of let's say the majority of fans right now, probably remember that. But you know, we all have a bit of recency bias, so we're kind of focused on the recent history between the two sides. But the players, most importantly, like in the majority of cases, what is it? Ireland have won, 35 or 36 out of the last 37, 38 games, something like that. They only know winning, which is a pretty powerful mindset coming into it. and gives them full of confidence. It kind of reminds me of that kind of Richie McCaw, Dan Carter side with New Zealand, in terms of, you know, that period from like 07 to the, was it 2015 World Cup, where they were just so dominant. It kind of builds a bit of a flywheel momentum kind of mindset for these guys. They don't take anything for granted, that's for sure. And Andy Farrell won't let them take anything for granted. But they're not fearful of going there now. But they should definitely understand the history between the two sides. And Andy Farrell is definitely one of the best people to remind them of that.
So if you look, say, post-World War II, there are, you know, large periods of English dominance, even going back, you know, I mentioned 1875, you know, Ireland didn't get their first win for about 12 years in that fixture. I think it was 1888 or around then when Ireland got their first win. And then post-World War II, stretches of English dominance. But this passage in the 70s, Ireland won five in a row in the championship in the 1970s. And there's a caveat to that because, you know, in 72, Scotland and Wales didn't travel to Dublin, the height of the Troubles, but England did go in 1973. And there's the famous John Pullen quote saying, you know, at least we turned up. You know, that was still an England side that in 73 won in New Zealand. So a good side. But those kind of, that the blurring of the lines there, Jamie, between history and sport has been apparent in this fixture. We'll get on to Croke Park later. Were you aware of that growing up as a boy, growing up as a young player? You know, what, say, happened in the 70s? What, say, happened going back even further?
No, I'm not that old, Chris. Thank you very much.
Well, that's what I said. You know, were you aware of it rather than did you live it? Yeah.
Probably not for a long time till, you know, I was in secondary school where you start understanding and learning about the history a bit more. But actually, the fact that they came over during that period has always shown the respect between the two sides, and they've always, at an organization level, and the two unions, they've always had each other's back, which I'm not sure can be said for others, but they've always backed each other at various different stages along the way. And that's why the respect between the two organizations comes from the top down. Obviously, there's rivalries always, the time between clubs and certain players and yada, yada, yada. And sometimes, okay, some players might not like others, but from the top down, there's always been a respect because of big moments like that where they come over when no one else would.
Mm-hmm. So that was the 70s when Ireland had this really dominant period. Five wins from 72 to 76. This Ireland crop are on four wins. They're looking to replicate that, albeit there have been sort of World Cup warm-ups in this run, whereas back in the 70s it was all championship. Your first memory, Jamie, because, not to remind you, but I just checked, you just turned 40. As a 39-year-old myself, we're not too dissimilar in age. And I remember pretty well that game at Twickenham when Simon Gagan scored in the 90s. Twickenham in 1994, 13-12 win at this real period of English dominance. That, for me, was my first England-Ireland memory. I wonder if it's sort of similar for you as well.
Yeah, well, you're either doing really good research and know that my favourite Irish player ever is Simon Gagan, or it's just pot luck. We'll go with the former. No, let's go with the former out of the latter.
Okay.
Right? He was my favourite player. I distinctly remember running around my house with a rugby ball pretending to be Simon Gagan. I didn't have the flowing locks of him back in the day, or whatever that type of haircut was, but I do often get slagged when I say he was my favourite player. They're like, oh, is that why you stood out in the wing all the time? that's probably what sparked my interest as a young lad in rugby, and then you couple that with the two kind of iconic moments from, like, well, then the Lions in 97 is really what actually kicked it off for me, that kind of behind the scenes one. But yeah, Six Nations, Simon Gagan running down the wing for Ireland scoring is probably my earliest memories of it.
Yeah, if anyone's not seen it, get it on YouTube. It's Twickenham 94, 13-12. It was Ireland's first win at Twickenham since 76. It's just a wicked try. He just gets half a yard on the outside and skins his man to score in the corner.
Wearing an absolute tent of a jersey as well.
Yeah, I mean, it's just quality. Like, it's just wicked footage. But those were the days where wins at Twickenham were like hen's teeth, yeah, weren't they? You know, 76, then 94. Then there was a win in 2004 where, you know, Agarra kicked the corners, Darcy came of age, Ireland got stuck into the line out, and the kind of English World Cup winning machine started to malfunction. That was in 2004. I think since then it's kind of been, you know, one win after the other at Twickenham. But 2001, I just want to ask you about the foot and mouth game when England were going for a slam and playing some unbelievable rugby. They then had to delay the game to post the Lions because of foot and mouth. But it was kind of an example of Ireland spoiling the English party. They also did it in 2011. They also did it in 2017. But back then, that was kind of what Ireland were about against England a lot of the time, just trying to get the odd win and mess things up for England. And it's come so full circle since then, hasn't it? To the point where it's so much more than trying to sort of stop England winning a slam. England haven't been in that position for ages, and it's Ireland going for back-to-back.
Yeah, and I think at the time, that was pure kind of emotional energy, I think, in a lot of cases. Like, the side is different now in terms of, like, emotionally, they're always there. Regardless of the game, there's just a high, like, regardless if it's Wales, England, New Zealand, Scotland, whoever, right? They're always there. And I think the inconsistency of Ireland way back when England were ahead in terms of, like, how, like, even being professionals and how
start of the Six Nations kind of era, yeah. Start of professionalism, yeah.
They were just so far ahead in so many facets. But what did Ireland have as they could for an England game, they could get that emotional intensity and energy where it needed to be for those type of games and cause the one off upsets. But they probably say it themselves, they couldn't deliver that level of consistency over a period of a Six Nations or a season or multiple seasons. And that's the kind of distinct difference between, there's a lot of factors go into it, but that's, I think, the biggest change from then to now. But they're always, you know, we're always capable of causing an upset. It was just, when was it during a Six Nations period? And you never knew.
Because while the amateur era was dominated by England, in the sort of the post-professionalism in 95, but let's take the Six Nations era.
Yeah.
You know, 24 matches, it's 14-10 to Ireland. That says a lot, doesn't it? 14-10 about maybe just how Ireland have embraced professionalism.
Yeah, well, like, majority of people are here from listening to this are probably from the UK and don't understand the difference between the system in England and the system in Ireland. So in Ireland, you've got four professional sides that are effectively owned by the IRFU, right? So it's all aligned to the national side and the national side always doing well. And back, I was literally the first kind of cohort to go into what is our academy system back in 2001. And like the way that system all works, make sure that it's always aligned to the national side. There's always alignment in terms of how that national side is playing and how that kind of waterfalls down. So when you get the players, and now when they come into the Leinster setup, for example, they're already pretty much athletically developed. They're highly coachable. They're very, very skillful in the way that Ireland need them to be and how they're playing. And so there's not a big change or step up or a whole lot of work needed when they step into the national environment from the club. And it's also different where we have the IRFU essentially outsource their player pipeline development to the school system here. They're doing better in terms of opening that up to the club system, but the schools do so much and invest so much in their players and their own player programs in each school that that's a big advantage that we have. So that infrastructure layer behind it, it's like next man up almost now. Mm-hmm. At this stage, in terms of the talent that's coming through, you know, you juxtapose that with England where the clubs own the player. And mm-hmm. they kind of give them to the national team. And it's a very they're coming from so many clubs. It's a very different step into the English environment. And they also, the English team don't get as much time with them throughout the season. So they might get a week before camp or maybe 10 days before Six Nations kicks off. Ireland, they're always getting 2 weeks before the first Six Nations game. They get a week sometime around Christmas as well. You know, they get a lot of time with them and the coaches are always talking. So it's just not as a big a step up. And I think what that leads to is the competitive advantage Ireland really have, I think, is the cohesion. And I think that cohesion across the Irish team is what I think is the real competitive advantage that they have.
Yeah. I mean, it's almost too much to go into now, but you then go even further back and you see the kind of problems Welsh rugby is constantly grappling with geographically in terms of identity, pro teams, what they should be called, where they should be based, how they should be labelled. Yeah. Yet Ireland, it was all on a plate, wasn't it? Here are our four provinces of the...
Oh, it was super clean.
Carved out from history. And then here you go. Let's hit the ground running with professionalism.
Yeah, and so you get players to buy straight away into the identity and the culture of each one. And then, you know, it's kind of... Even if we go to our national sports like GAA, football and hurling, you know, that's a real kind of community type sport that bubbles up to our county level. And so we're very used to kind of like being part of a club, representing a wider group, and then rowing in together with others that you're a rival with one week, and then you got to row in the next week. So it's kind of just built into Irish people. And then obviously you stick a green jersey on us and we'll go to war for you.
Yeah, for sure. So that's where Ireland maybe have some, you know, there's other things people could quibble with the system. And you know,
I will give the credit to the RFU for having the foresight to have it always aligned to the national side and owning the clubs as well, therefore owning the game here essentially.
But that's where you've got a league. You know, the league has been English for decades. That's been the English strength, hasn't it? The players that are aligned to their club, yeah. And there's lots of different, and there's great rivalries between the clubs, and of course there's brilliant inter-pro rivalries. But across the URC, for example, You might not have huge rivalries country to country, a league like England. So there are reasons where there are ways that the England system...
Oh, there's pluses and minuses to both. Yeah, 100%.
I mean, it's just a great example of the Irish system works for Ireland, doesn't it? In terms of history, geography, it's almost got the perfect playing numbers. So there's competition for places, but not this constant dialogue the England head coach gets where there's always another cab off the rank. We're digressing. It's a whole other podcast, I think. But it is important background to why... You're seeing a situation where Ireland are not just competitive with England, but constantly getting the better of them. And I mentioned the 14-10 record in the Six Nations era. I just want to talk to you about 2007 and Croke Park, Jamie. Mm. You were an international. You weren't involved in that game. You did play in 09, if I've got my research right. But, you know, we spoke about the lines between history and politics and sport. And with the backdrop to that Croke Park fixture, basically English people going back to Croke Park for the first time since Bloody Sunday. Man, what an emotionally charged occasion. You know, I wasn't there, but you just have to hear from people involved in Dublin at the time around it to know that was an incredibly emotional, poignant, powerful day in Irish sport, 2007 at Croke Park.
Yeah, I was at that time, I'd been capped, but I was like 23rd man on the day. So I'd been in camp, trained with them all week, did the warm up actually for that game, and then I was sitting in the stand watching it. And it was a pretty poignant moment for all the reasons that you just said. And then when you heard, you know, Aron Navin being played for the Irish side, and then I think the respect for, at the time it was God Save the Queen, the respect for that, you could hear a pin drop. Like, and because
was that a concern before that it would be booed or cheered or something?
From what I kind of remember, like, not that it was concerned, no one just knew.
Yeah, sure. So unknown
because it just God Save the Queen had never been played in Croke Park. So it, in terms of historical moments, no one knew what was going to happen, but you could hear a pin drop. Such was the level of respect that rugby fans give, but the Irish, back to what we talked about earlier about what the Irish give to the English, particularly just what we talk about and them coming over during the Troubles when no one else would, and so on and so forth. But it was an emotionally charged game, and we just knew that, like, there was no way England were going to win that day. It was as simple as that. Like, just given all these factors feeding in, that just added an extra 20-30% in terms of, like, emotional intensity and energy that the Ireland players had. And actually at the time, I believe we were doing this kind of behind the scenes video that actually came out, and I think that's the game that the infamous Paul O'Connell speech and put the fear of God in him thing. I think it's that game, but you know, he probably said it anyway if it wasn't that game, if I'm honest, and probably said a lot more.
It's now that game, the after dinner circuit. Make sure it's that game. It's got to work.
They're right.
It?
Yeah, but that's Paulie's go to. But it's, I just remember the energy in the place was, it was like your hairs were standing up because it's just like the electricity.
Different to normal. Yeah,
it was a different level. And then, you know, when we played them in 09, yes, there was a level of intensity there, but it wasn't the same feeling just in the city that week around it.
Yeah. No, amazing occasion. I remember watching on TV and just, oh. But then I suppose, look, that emotion can sometimes spill over the wrong way. You've got to keep your clarity of thought and vision, haven't you? Even though there is so much of this emotion swirling around, not just you, but the whole stadium and the whole city.
Well, that's the thing with sport, particularly when you're going to battle, right? Particularly in rugby, it's contact sport. You've got to be mentally there, emotionally there, and then like the physical preparation, all that kind of takes care of itself. But that's always the worry, where it spills over and you do something in the heat of the battle that is just a reaction because you're just on edge, and it can spill over. But that's the sign of great sides, where they bring it to the edge and don't let it spill over. Like that's like the English team pre-World Cup when they won it back in 2003. You know what I mean? Like their intensity of playing and the energy was right up there, but they never let it spill over, because sides now or sides in general would just punish you with either taking 3 points or a release valve, and you kick down the field. Like no one was getting a red card back then or a yellow card back then, unlike today. But you still got punished and you let the pressure valve off.
Yeah, I mean, we should give the 2003 lot their due, because even though they got burgled in 01, the Keith Wood try and the foot and mouth game, they won 50-18 in 2000, 45-11 in 2002, and 42-6 at Lansdowne in 2003. I mean,
they were dominant.
Wow, what a team. Okay, so let's get into a few games that mean a lot to you in your career. So we touched upon Croke in 07 and Croke in 09, which you won a close one. That was when Danny got yellow carded and Martin Johnson hit the roof. You won at Twickenham in 2010. You played in that game. Tommy Bowe, who's with us in commentary on Saturday, scored a worldie. Your memories of that, because I know it's happened a fair bit, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 times in the Six Nations era. It's still a win at Twickenham. I'm sure you went mad for it.
Well, and they were, you got to remember, like, it was pretty rare that we got a win in Twickenham in general, particularly our group coming through. Like at that time, you know, myself, Tommy, Tomás O'Leary was playing, I think, you had Rob Kearney. You know, we were starting to kind of come through as well and try and take on ownership of it. It was for us, it was huge, because I remember going there in 08 and getting it served to us, particularly at the scrum. I'll never forget all day, particularly being 8, I just had this scrum just coming back on me the whole time, and it was a nightmare. They were just so physically dominant. And I remember coming into it going, we can't let that happen. We can't let them stake their claim on this. And obviously, we had a couple of, not tricks up our sleeves, but we had a couple of plays that we thought could expose it. And Tommy's one kind of encapsulate that. I'll just never forget him kind of he broke it down the seam of the line-out, wasn't it?
And it was off the line-out. It was actually exactly the same, very similar move to what the box did with JP Peterson scoring in 09, and also a game you would have played in that second test, just kind of off the line out, 9 coming round, blindside winger just carves up.
I never forget Tommy as he's in the dead ball area and he's running into the middle of the post and he's giving the kind of infamous Tommy Bowe finger up in the air.
Like, put it down, just, man. Yeah.
But I was like, yes.
Yeah.
But there was a huge one for us. For that group, it was a huge moment for us. Particularly coming off the back of 09 and trying to get a win and trying to win a championship when Ireland have England and France away was a lot more difficult for us. And we felt like, you know, that was just a good flag for us to put down as a group. But also, to be honest, for me, it was still fresh in my memory, 08, getting absolutely served. And we just kind of wanted to put a line under the sand on that one.
Yeah, sure. So a few other games just to touch upon. There was a period 12-13-14 where Stuart Lancaster was building nicely, 3 wins in a row for England. But you did win in 11 in Dublin, stopping the England slam. And you also did it in 17, where you were meant to play, weren't you? But then pulled out just before and didn't play again. Is that right?
Yeah. I got a career-ending injury in the warm-up, of all bloody things. Which was infuriating.
How did that happen?
God, we could get into it. But essentially, you know, what I ended up doing was doing a lot of nerve damage to my kind of my back, which had an effect on my left leg. So essentially, my left leg went dead in the warm up from a collision. And yeah, it was weird. I had this weird moment where it was like, I had like, it was good cop, bad cop on either shoulder, where it was like, you know, one guy is saying like, you can't, your leg is dead, you can't really run here. And then the other one saying, shut up, get on the field and get a cap. Because I was on, what was it? I was on 95 Ireland caps at that stage. And I was like, come on, get one more. Get the 101 international ones. I was trying to chase down 100 caps for Ireland at that stage, and thought I was in a good place to get it. But yeah, I kind of knew that, particularly against a side like England, if you're not 100%, you're like, they'll expose the weakness straight away. And we hadn't had a great run that year, and we really wanted that win, and I had to kind of remove myself from the game, going over to the physio, and anyway, yeah, very quickly transpired that I couldn't play, and Joe in his very ruthless style was like, saying to the doctor, can he play? He's like, no. And then straight away, there was no like, oh, sorry mate, it was like, right, Peter in, CJ,
yeah,
you're
the, get on with like, it, yeah.
Oh. I was like, I thought it was more valuable.
That was, you know, a mad sliding doors moment, because as well as ending your career, Omani then plays, he is a blinder,
yeah,
gets
yeah.
on the Lions tour, captains the Lions in the first test. So mad how things work out.
But. It was, but it showed, Joe had actually created such a good machine where everyone could just slot in and out, in terms of everyone knew the various different plays and permutations and all that sort of stuff. And it was seamless. And a player like Pete as well, a great leader, and the aspect of his game that made a big impact in that game in terms of shutting down the England lineout in particular, just had a huge impact on it. And yeah, it was kind of bittersweet. I didn't know at the time my career was finished, obviously, but it was very bittersweet. Kind of, you're meant to start, and then you know it's a line season, and you got to get out there, have a big game, all that sort of things. But you end up, you're on the sideline watching the guy who's effectively stepped in for you having an absolute blinder. You're like, oh, but it was great to see Ireland kind of win, and particularly
stopped England's. England were on a roll then, weren't they? They'd won slam in 16, unbeaten all through 16 under Eddie. Had won four out of their first four. Had already wrapped the title up by the time they came to Dublin, looking to break the long unbeaten run, the record. And it didn't happen.
We'd done it before though, Chris. We'd done it that season before against New Zealand. And so we were kind of like, obviously people talking a lot about the run that they were on. We did something similar against New Zealand in the November series beforehand in Chicago, where they were on a big run. And we talked about that, kind of going like, everyone's hyping them up. Look at these guys, yada, yada, yada. When we don't have...
That was the motivation.
When we're not the favourites here, but like, we've done it. We've done it this season. We've done it against New Zealand this season. You know, there's nothing for us to fear here. And actually, there's nothing for us to lose. So let's go play.
Okay, I really want to pick you up on that, because it feels as if the tables have completely turned from, say, 2017 to 2024 and the psychology. And we'll talk about that after this.
On the Football Daily Podcast.
The Women's Football Weekly.
With me, Ellen White.
Ellen White coming forward. There is the second.
And me, Ben Haynes, with some of the biggest names in the WSL, joining us every week to discuss everything that's happening in the women's game.
Right after the World Cup, got told, we're going to America. I thought, amazing. 10 days in training, did my meniscus, and the next day they flew to America.
Blocked header 6 yards out, Ellen White!
The Women's Football Weekly Podcast.
New episodes every Wednesday.
Subscribe to the Football Daily on BBC Sounds.
Right. You've chanced upon some psychology that could be completely flip-reversed for this year. Because to catch up from 17 on, you know, England had what a great win that was in Dublin in 19 that perhaps kind of started the Irish wobble after being so good in 18, Ireland. Team of the year, coach of the year, Johnny Sexton was player of the year in 18. England had a great win in Dublin that perhaps just started Ireland's wobble. England went on to reach the World Cup final that year. Then England, I mean, man, what was it? From sort of 2019, but 2020, they were regularly, you know, there was four games in a row where England would just dominate Ireland physically, wouldn't they? Start of the Andy Farrell regime, end of the Joe Schmidt, 2-19, 2-20 with the Autumn Nations Cup. So here we are 4 years on. and it's completely reversed. First of all, can you remember an Ireland team coming to Twickenham as such heavy favourites?
No. Like, no. But Ireland have consistently evolved their game from... The problem with the Joe probably got himself into, he probably had I would say at around that 2017-18 season, he probably had a decision to make going, do we evolve the way Ireland are playing, or do we just do what we're doing better? And I think he went with the latter rather than the former there. And the way sport is, teams just caught up and figured out how to actually unpick Ireland, right? And that's what got them into trouble. But I think when Andy took over them, he is not only brought through, he's capped an incredible amount of players, and he's evolved the way they're playing. And even now, during this Six Nations, he's even tweaking the way they're defending, right? I think he is anyway. And they've consistently evolved their game. England, on the other hand, I think went backwards after the 2019 World Cup in terms of how they were playing. And I think that's evident in the iteration of coaching staff around them. So there was no level of consistency, I think, there. And they didn't evolve how they were playing. And even though they finished up, you know, third in... I think it was third, wasn't it? In the last World Cup. Mm-hmm. I think that was a bit of a red herring, given the draw that you had and stuff. And yeah, look, there were some good games for England, but I can't see an evolution in their playing style. I think for that reason, they're going to struggle against an Irish side who are just tweaking what they're doing, tweaking the players that are there. Like, James Ryan now can't start a game. You know what I mean? This is mad. There are constant battles in the back row. You think Johnny Sexton stepping away, they're going to have issues, but Jack Crowley has stepped in there and he's running a good show so far. You have battles in the centre between who are you going to start? You know, Gary, Bundy, Robbie, Stuart McCluskey. They think there's going to be issues with Hugo Keenan being out, but Frawley did absolutely fine. The speed at which they play and the relentlessness at which they keep the pace of the game up and the high ball and playing minutes, you can see even the way they score, right? They score most of their points in the second half of either half. And that means they're playing at such a pace and are able to maintain that teams struggle to stay with them. And particularly when you give them, like, they're getting a lot of, you know, 0 to 3 second ball, no matter what the side that is. That's incredibly hard to consistently defend against for like 40 minutes.
Yeah, because you go back, you use that 2020 as a bookmark. Yeah, there were two games at Twickenham, one that was just before COVID. I think it was on a Sunday. England won, and Eddie Jones declared they could have declared at half time. That was his line after, because England was so on top. And then 2020, the Autumn Nations Cup, no fans, but Johnny May scored that amazing try.
Yep.
And England were always had Ireland at arm's length. But 4 years on, England have chopped and changed head coach, as we know. They've had about a million different attack coaches, a million different iterations about their style of play. 1 minute they're flat and fast, the next minute they're New England, then they're the front foot team. There's this constant kind of flipping and flopping over what kind of team they want to be. And that's not just this era, that goes to the end of the Eddie regime as well. Whereas Ireland have just seen them grow and grow and grow under Andy Farrell, and with the odd tweak in the backroom staff, largely a very settled coaching team. So when we look at Saturday, with the way the two teams have gone in polar opposite directions since, say, 2020 after the 19 World Cup, is there any chance that England prey on that spirit of 2017 that you said? You know, there's so much chat about Ireland and how amazing they are. There's a level of schadenfreude amongst the Irish rugby public, isn't there? Because they've never enjoyed dominance like this, especially over England. And it's great to see, because they're pushing the boundaries. But does that element of it concern you? Not necessarily that Ireland will be complacent, but England have got this massive motivation not to let Ireland roll up to Twickenham and tickle their tummies.
So there's two things that I think are straight away there. I think, okay, yeah, England will be there mentally, emotionally, physically, right? They're going to be there. They're defending at home. You've got a side rocking in who are looking like they could go back-to-back Grand Slam champions, right? It's Ireland in your back garden. They'll want to defend that.
But it's not enough. You don't think they're good enough to execute the emotional side into a tactical, technical execution.
And not for 80 minutes.
I don't think they are.
And this is not a slight at the players. I think you've got amazingly talented players. I just don't think the English side is playing to the strengths of those players. I think they're playing a style that doesn't suit them. I think Ireland are going to exploit a lot of the chinks in the armor there. But if we look at Ireland for a second, they actually haven't been amazing, let's say, right? Or consistently amazing over periods of 80 minutes. But what's been really encouraging, just take the Wales game, for example, you know, they have to defend hard for what, that kind of first 20 minutes of the second half. Wales are probably unlucky not to come away with a try. But Ireland kind of roll up the sleeves, they stay in the fight, they get back up there and they get the bonus point in the end, right? At the depth of the game. And I think, not that it would have been a fright to them, it definitely keeps any sort of complacency in check, gives them plenty to work on. Because England have shown enough pictures defensively for Ireland to understand how to move them around, create the space and exploit the space wherever it is. Because the challenge with playing against Ireland is, okay, they're playing at such ferocity and speed. Okay, you gotta slow down their set piece, you gotta slow down the ruck ball. But then once you get into the rhythm of the game, they've just got threats everywhere. Everyone can carry, everyone can pass and offload the ball, and they're constantly mixing up the attacking picture that you're seeing. They're using a very good kicking game. They'll just kick straight over to the corner, over the edge, to their wingers if there's space there. They can pass to get there. Or, as we saw in the opening game against France, they're very comfortable even just going to the line, little pop passes, people just coming from and out to in line, stuff like that, where Tyke Furlong goes through, really expanded their offloading game. They have a multitude of threats, coupled with ball carriers who will just stick it under their jersey and get over the game line consistently, particularly in the back row when you look at Caelan Dyrus, who's just an absolute worldie in my book. But also with Porter, Furlong, Dan Sheen, who's probably the best hooker in the world right now. He's like another back row. And then the depth that they have, like which showed at the weekend, where they bring on people like a Jack Conan, a Ryan Baird, who are always going to get you a few line breaks as well, particularly when sides are tired. I haven't seen what the bookies are saying, Chris, but I think England, in order for England to win, Ireland have to go down to like 14 or 13 players, and I think England need a couple of trick plays up their sleeve.
Yeah, so you're not fearful in any way that Ireland, you know, you're completely confident psychologically this Ireland team are so far down the track that even if the bookies are saying you're going to win at Twickenham by 15 points, they'll be, yeah, we're cool with that, we'll go and do it.
I think that mantle of them being the favourite does not irk these guys. They are well used to that. Mm-hmm. And they've had a big enough upset on a big stage to understand, like, you know, not that they're thinking of it, but they got a taste of that against New Zealand in the World Cup, right? And I think the big upset with Ireland around the World Cup was because we were actual genuine contenders for the first time. And that's what probably the big upset was. But I don't think they're complacent. I don't think Andy will let them complain. Look at the coaching staff there, by the way, right? You've got Andy, okay, who has been there, done that, worn the T-shirt. You've got Paul O'Connell there, right? You've got John Fogarty, all guys, Simon Eastby, all guys who have been there. So they understand that side of the game as well. Mike Cant as well. So, like, they're not going to let that complacency set in.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, it's 11 points. One bookie's got it. England's 72 outsiders at Twickenham. I mean, that's pretty mad. And just finally, just on the fixture as a whole, Jamie, it's Monday. We're building up to England-Ireland week. No doubt an enjoyable time for Ireland fans, a prosperous time for ex-players in the Twickenham corporate machine. And you've captained this fixture, haven't you? You're on captain in 2013. Like, does it... You know, what was that like, and does this fixture mean anything more to you than anything else, or is it just another game, especially for Ireland at the moment?
I think in terms of narrative, you'll probably hear guys saying it's just another game, and you kind of have to approach it like the process coming into the game won't change, right? In terms of how they structure their week, how they go about it, all that sort of stuff.
But there's an added emotional intensity that comes into it, particularly any away game, right? Because it's that bit harder. The fans like bring in extra energy when you rock up to Twickenham, that, you know, where they park the bus and the walk in through the crowd, which I think is awesome, by the way. I think in terms of arriving at stadiums, it's outside of when you used to arrive for a Toulon game. That was probably one of the coolest experiences ever in Twickenham. But I don't like otherwise, you know, it just goes back to the age old adage rivalry between Ireland and England, and that's all you need, to be honest. And it comes back to what I said at the start. We could be playing tiddlywinks, Chris, and I will want to dominate you. And every Irishman will want to do that. And the same with the English guys, right? But they're not going to fear coming there. They've been there. They've won there consistently. They've beaten England consistently over the last period. So they're not going to fear there. But they're fully aware that they've been in position England have been in. And they're fully aware of people can pull it out of the bag. So that's why the complacency won't set in. And that's why they'll still do their homework. They'll still try and unpick them. But they'll pay them respect that they're due. But mostly will focus on themselves and their way of playing. Because that's all you can do as a player. You can only focus on what you guys are doing, understand what they do attacking wise, but then it's all about you and enforcing your game on them, and that's what will be their main focus.
Awesome. Great place to finish, Jamie. Been a pleasure taking a bit of a trip down memory lane, but also looking ahead to England against Ireland, which is going to be on 5 Live, the whole game on BBC Sounds, all the build-up through the week on the Rugby Union Daily podcast, Nation Spot tomorrow, loads more to come. But the England-Ireland rivalry, we are set up for Twickenham on Saturday. Great way to start the week, Jamie. Good to speak to you.
Thanks, guys. I'll be listening.
Yeah, good stuff. Thanks a lot. At least we've got one. Cheers.
The drama.
They're having to be separated. They've both been shown the red card.
The entertainment.
And it's
the superstars.
Foden! Oh, yes!
What a goal.
Welcome to the Planet Premier League podcast. I'm Mark Chapman, and every week, Cesc Fabregas, Nader Manua and myself talk all things Premier League.
They have this dynamism and this quality that they can play anywhere. They need to prove themselves in scoring more and more and more goals.
I think if they don't win the title this year, the season is a failure in the league.
Planet Premier League. Listen on BBC Sounds.